The Autobiography of C.H. Spurgeon. Chapter 77, Memories of My Father, by Pastor Charles Spurgeon. Charlie and Tommy are good little boys. When they're asleep, they don't make any noise. CHS. That is a very precious name, which Christ puts into our mouths when he bids us say to God, Our Father, which art in heaven. And there is a wonderful sweetness when we come to know that we may call him our husband. I do not like to compare the two and say which title is to be preferred, whether husband or father. They are both unutterably sweet when they are enjoined to the full. CHS, in sermon preached at the Tabernacle, March 1st, 1883. My dear mother has told, and is telling, in the sweetest manner possible, much of tender interest concerning her beloved husband. She records in her own inimitable fashion many touching incidents in the life of him who is so dear to her heart, and her charming writing proves how unutterably sweet, because enjoined to the full, the title, My Husband, is to her. There is only one other who can write the words, My Father, after the illustrious name of Charles Haddon Spurgeon, and such a father. Blessed be his tender mercy. Oh, for the tongue of the learned, in the pen of a ready writer, for then could I hope to speak and write love's eulogy on one whose like we cannot hope to see again. Never had any son a kinder, wiser, happier, holier, or more generous sire, and I count it one of the highest honors of my life to be permitted to place within the already well-stored casket a few gems which memory has preserved through that sweet relationship which, in God's great goodness, I, as one of my father's sons, was privileged to enjoy. There was one trait in his noble and godly character, which, among many others, always shone with a luster peculiarly its own. His humility was of a Christ-like character, and its demands heartiest commendation from those who speak or write about him. The words of eulogy concerning himself were ever painful to him, his motto in this, as in all other matters, being, Not I, but Christ. Yet from his own loving child, some mend of praise may surely come, and the son would fain render all the due honor to the best of fathers. His blameless example, his holy consistency, his genteel love, his generous liberality, his wise counsel, and his fearless fidelity to God and his truth are all on a par with his fatherliness, and in my heart, as in all those with whom he came into contact, these qualities have been enshrined. The matchless grace and goodness manifested in the home found their counterpart in his public career, and proved how completely the spirit of the master permeated the whole life of his servant. What my father was to me, to the Church of Christ, and to the world at large, none can ever fully estimate. But those who knew him best understood the secret of his magic power, for they felt that he had been with Jesus, and that Jesus lived in him. The earliest recollections of my dear father, which I have retained, are naturally those associated with my childhood, and my heart is filled anew with joyful pleasures as I think again and again of the doings of the days gone by. I must have been a very small boy when I capered about with great delight because my father had provided for the entertainment of the natives of Walton-on-the-Naves a firework display on the sands, and among the visitors for a season at the then slightly known and out-of-the-way watering place. Little Charlie was made glad by looking at skyrockets and listening to the bangs of squibbles. This may seem a small matter to report, but it is indicative of a prominent feature in my father's character, inasmuch as he constantly rejoiced in giving pleasant surprises wherever he could. Nor was this the only time when, to give his children some fun, he made the 5th of November an excuse for indulging in works of fire. I remember, too, how an improvised swing had been hung between two trees for the amusement of the boys, but an untimely fall of one of the twins precluded all further use of this outdoor gymnasium. Father felt, however, that athletic exercises were conducive to the health of growing lads, so he arranged for the erection of a substantial horizontal bar and swing for their use, thus giving evidence of his thoughtful love and sympathetic consideration for their well-being. I can seem to see, as it were, but yesterday, their bright face beaming with smiles as he gave his would-be carpenter's sons a present in the form of a basket of tools and a box of nails, all the impediments needed for the full equipment of a master in the trade were to be found within that workman's basket, and I shall never forget how Father watched and waited for us to discover among the tools a neat roll of rag, where we were puzzling our brains to find out why this was included. He laughingly explained that, in all probability, we had cut our fingers, we should find out the use of it. The providing of the bandage for wounded amateurs amplified his power of forethought and also his prolonged common sense. I still have in my possession a silver medal bearing the following inscription, presented to Master Charles Spurgeon by the United Kingdom Band of Hope Union, January 1865, to call to mind a noble occasion when the tabernacle was crowded with a vast audience gathered to hear the famous lecture on Sermons and Candles, delivered by my dear father. And well do I remember coming forward to receive from Mr. W.R. Sealway a broad band of blue ribbon to which was attached this medallion of membership, and how after he placed it around my neck, with trembling voice I acknowledged the kind gift and expressed the hope that I might be a teetotaler all my life. What a wonderful light the lecturer threw upon his subject. I can well be imagined with what interest the little lads in their 9th year looked and listened as the different candles were lighted and sermonettes sparkled. Most vividly do I recollect how daintily my dear father walked across the platform, as if to avoid the pools of water and heaps of refuge to be found in the streets of an oriental city, bearing in his hand a small cane, at the end of which hung a colored paper lantern, thus illustrating Psalms 119:105. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet, and a light unto my path. I must confess that I had, even then, a wish to do the self-same thing, little dreaming that, in afterlife, the dear Father, whom I was watching with such intense delight, would make over to me, as a love gift, the whole of the apparatus he had used, with a bound copy of the lecture, saying, "There, Charlie, my boy, you can go on giving it." Two other illustrations fastened themselves upon my youthful mind, the first being one in which the lecturer's assistant represented the tempter discovering the weak place in the Christian's character, watching for the defective spot in the lantern. The helper, by the use of a pair of bellows, soon put the candle out. The other emblem, which I specially noted, was the one described by dear father as the greatest display over fireworks. Suspended from the roof of the tabernacle was a massive candelabra, which, to the young onlookers was most attractive for its brightness and beauty, and though one of such tender years could hardly appreciate all that was then said concerning the Church of Christ in its multi-simplicity, variety, and unity, he could not forget the harmless mirth expressed in guiltless laughter, which followed the lecturer's remark that one strong old Baptist had assured him that the dibs gave the best light. There are only a few of my happy memories of that memorable band of hope meeting. These are: I prize immensely the first letter I ever received from my beloved father. It is written to a little boy, and has therefore on the top of the notepaper a colored view of Helgoland. I feel constrained to treat the publication of the letter in the same manner as age has treated the original, and to give it in pieces. It runs thus: My dear Charles, I am very glad that you wrote a nice little note to your dear mother, and I hope it is a sign that you are always going to be diligent and thoughtful, and this will be a good, glad thing indeed. I am delighted to hear that you are doing so well at college. Give my love to all the students, and tell Mr. Rogers that it always cheers me to know that the brethren bear me up in their prayers. On this little island, there is a lighthouse. You see it at the top on the left of the picture. It is much needed, for many vessels were wrecked here. We live down below on the beach, near the square tower with a flag on it. This is a bath house. Steamers come every 2 days, and then we can send letters. At other times, we are far off from everyone, alone in the wide, wide sea. We have sheep's milk, for there is no room for cows. Fish is very plentiful and very good. My dear boy, I trust that you will prove by the whole of your future life that you are truly converted to God. Your actions must be the chief proof. Remember, trees are known by their fruit, and Christians by their deeds. God bless you forever and ever. Mother sends her kindest love, and so does your loving father, C.H. Spurgeon. The reference to doing so well at college needs just this explanation. One of the students was, for a time, our tutor, and naturally, dear father took a deep interest in our educational progress. Pastor Harry Rylands Brown, now of Darjeeling, was the good brother who had us in training, and from that day to this, teacher and pupil have been close friends. The first letter to our firstborn exhibits the tender love that the president always had for the college, which he often termed, among his many works for the Lord, his firstborn and best beloved. Among the many gifts we received from Father, I recall one occasion when a piece of gold was bestowed as a birthday present upon his two boys, who, thereby, became the proud possessors of a magic lantern and a few comic slides. When the toy was brought home, the kind owner gave instructions to the cook to allow the boys to show their pictures as often as they liked in that portion of the kitchen which would not interfere with culinary arrangements, saying, at the same time, "It won't last long. They'll soon be tired of it." This prophecy was quite sufficient to set up within the minds of the purchasers of this very pretty thing a strong determination that they would not get tired of it. By the combined efforts of the two brothers, further pictures were produced upon glass, which necessitated the constant use of the lantern to test their artistic qualities. And secretly, it was resolved that a special series should be prepared, so that during the coming Christmas, the services of Monsignor C. and T. Spurgeon might be requisited for the entertainment of the children who would frequent Yuletide parties. Several engagements of this nature have been secured, and professional fees attaining the lecturing exhibition had been received. They were able to hand over to the president of the Pastor's College the sum of 10 guineas, and in doing so, perhaps somewhat sauciously, reminded their beloved father that they weren't tired of the magic lantern yet. This little episode greatly charmed the heart of the original donor of the 10 shillings and proved the possibility of making a small capital bring in a large interest. When I was about 12 years of age, I was riding home with my dear father in the Brockham after an evening service at the Tabernacle. It was blowing great guns. There was a heavy downpour of rain, and a keen east wind with a cutting edge was driving it upon the pavement. It was a dark, dreary night, and as we came to a point where crossroads met, Father's eyes quickly discerned a person whom he judged to be a poor woman, hurriedly rushing across the stones through the storm. With her skirt gathered around her head, she looked a weird spectacle, and in a moment his heart was moved with compassion towards her. He cried out, "Charlie, stop the coachman. Jump out and see if there is anything wrong with that poor creature, and find out whether you can help her." Of course, I sprang out of the carriage at once, but I wondered what I was going to say to the woman. I overtook her and said, "Excuse me, but is there anything the matter? Are you in trouble?" She replied, "Oh dear, no. I have been to see a friend and have been caught in the storm. I came out without an umbrella, so I am running home as fast as I can." On repeating to dear father what she had said, he exclaimed, "That is a relief to me. But what would he have done if she had been in distress?" He was glad that she was all right, but I remember thinking, as I sat there by his side, "Dear me, that woman is nothing to him," yet in his heart went out towards her in pity and sympathy. It went out after everyone who was in need and distress, and if his hand could help, its bounty speedily followed the leadings of his great heart of love. Well, my brother and I were at Mr. Oakland's school at Brighton. I wrote to tell my father that we had started a little prayer meeting in the master's drawing room among our schoolfellows. In reply, he wrote, "Dear boy, one of my sweetest joys is to hear that a spirit of prayer is in your school and that you participate in it. To know that you love the Lord and are mighty in prayer would be my crowning joy. The hope that you do so already is a happy one to me. I should like you to preach, but it is best that you pray. Many a preacher have proved a castaway, but never one who has truly learned to pray. I understand that in the first chapter on A Traveler's Letter Home, Father describes the very tour concerning which he wrote to me in this interesting fashion. I have had a very happy journey and am very much better. You can trace my trip thus. I have been in stately Brussels, sniffed in odorous cologne, slept in Rhine-washed Mayence, inspected Regal Munich, rested in rustic Botzen, floated in Venice, and roamed in Imperial Rome. This reference to various places on the continent reminds me of the great enjoyment dear father gave his two sons in August 1871 when he took us to Antwerp. As we went through the different churches there, he seemed to know all about every picture, each pulpit, and even the tombs, and he could tell us about the famous artists, sculptors, and carvers, upon whose works we were gazing in boyish wonders. It was a treat to hear him describe the Calvary outside St. Paul's Church. Some persons unacquainted with my father have said that he was no artist, but if they had known more of him and heard him dilate upon the noblest works by the best Flemish masters, they would have thought otherwise. He found sermons while he looked upon the elevation of the cross and the descent from it by Rubens, and with an equal happiness drew lessons from the masterpieces of Van Dyck and Snyders. It needs a true connoisseur to discover the hidden meaning of the artist's mind as portrayed upon the canvas, and thus to reveal to the spirit of the picture. Such a gift was his. Standing before the magnificent pulpit in St. Andrew's Church, he pointed out the cross, which bears the apostle's name, and then gave us an exquisite sermonette upon the miraculous draught of fishes, illustrated by the carved figures of Christ and his two disciples, with their fishing boat and the nets containing the unprecedented take. I well remember, too, how Father's righteous indignation was kindled as we stooped in the famous cathedral and witnessed the absurdities connected with the funeral of some great personage. No sooner had the gloomy cortege quitted the building to a slow and solemn rendered by the clustered monks than a gorgeous wedding procession with all the joyous accompaniments of marriage festivals took its place, and thus the whole scene was quickly changed, and the mournful was succeeded by the nuptial jubilee. The experienced preacher extemporized a brief discourse upon the ever-varying vicissitudes of human life, as set forth by the two events, and the truths he thus inculcated still abide, as we remember that our joys and sorrows are not so far apart as we are apt to think, for sunbeams and shadows are closely aligned after all. It has been my privilege to accompany dear Father on many occasions to the Lake O'Cakes in the County of Lakes, and never had any tourist a more excellent guide. He was a venerable walking encyclopedia, so full of information and so gracious in imparting it, that a holiday spent with him was as instructive as a term at school, and to me far preferable. It sometimes became amusing to see how eager folks were to show any little kindness to him. On one occasion, we were passengers on Mr. Duncan's yacht, Verana, and had made the passage of the canal as far as Loch, where in one of the sheltered and biscuit bays we had anchored for the night. Next morning, when breakfast was being prepared, the steward discovered that the supply of milk had run short, and that he must needs visit the shore to replenish the store. Standing on deck, I watched the progress of our caterer as he climbed the hillside and made application at a small cottage on the border of the wood, which covered the slope. Presently, a woman made her appearance, and then it soon became evident that she and the steward were having a somewhat lively conversation. In a few minutes, the man returned, but alas, minus the milk. He told us that he came back, that the lady of the house would only supply it on condition that he would let her see Mr. Spurgeon, whose name he had used as his last argument. Upon my dear father learning that this appearance was required for the purpose, with his usual readiness to supply the milk of human kindness, he came up on deck and waved his hand in the direction of the cottage. The woman at once recognized him and commenced the Scottish reel of delight. The steward had meanwhile again pulled to the shore. He soon disappeared within the house, and in a few seconds he came out bearing a huge jug brimful of pure milk, for which the worthy dame would not accept even twopence a quart. At another time, I was staying with my father at a much-loved and often frequented spot in dear old Surrey, where his presence was always looked upon as a high honor. The villagers had been successful in securing a fine, large carp from the pond which skirted the green, and they thought that such a good catch would at once be sent to the notable visitor, so that with great ceremony a deputation of rustics was appointed to wait upon him. The best that any could give to him was never reckoned too good for a man they loved. And though in both these instances the gifts were small, they were to prove the affectionate regard in which he was held by the multitudes of people of all classes. Testimonials amounting to thousands of pounds have been presented to him by admiring adherents, and while the applause of enthusiastic crowds have greeted him as the hero of the hour, he has, in grateful terms, acknowledged the favor showered upon him while passing on the praises to the Lord. He has handed over the purses and their contents to the service of his master. Never did a more liberal soul, nor a more grateful man, breathe than my father. It was a memorable period in my history when, upon leaving school in 1874, I decided to enter upon a commercial career. If every son upon commencing his life's battle received such a letter as the following, there would probably be fewer defeats sustained and more victories gained. Winchester, June 26, 1874. My dear Charlie, your kind letter was very pleasant to me and made my birthday much happier. I am right glad to see that you intend putting on the armor in earnest for the battle of life into which you must now enter. We have to carry babies, but it is always a glad occasion when they run alone. After that comes another period of carrying on a larger scale, and then comes, as now, the time for another running alone, as to manly, serious, earnest, industrious life work. We do not expect you to run in this sense all at once, but we shall not be surprised if there are some stumbles and failures, but we shall hope to see you an upright man, capable of any honest achievement, and bending all your strength to accomplish an honorable life work. I am full of hope about you, and if I feel any anxiety, it is because I love you so well that I want you to be a greater success than other young men. I believe you love the Lord, and that is the main thing. The next thing is, stick to it. Leave childish things once for all and buckle to the work. It will not be pleasant, and it may even become irksome. But the harder you work at first, the less you will have to do in later life. The times are so pushing that you must put out all your energies, and above all, you must be careful and very persevering. And then, with God's blessing, you will soon take a position to which your father and mother can point with pleasure. If you do not preach the gospel, you must help me to do it and make money for Jesus. With my two sons at my side, I shall be able to do marvels if the Lord be with us. Letters from your dear mother are encouraging. Do not write to me here as I am fleeting. Your loving father, C.H. Spurgeon. End of chapter 77. Having been read by Peter John Parisi, also known as Brian Dean, none of my audios are copyrighted. Please feel free to make as many copies as you desire to the glory of God.